It is 8:33, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Sorry to start you a little late there, but had to let Amy wrap up her thoughts. So
Amy Goodman was on earlier.
Such a rare treat. All right, so plenty to cover and big events happening all weekend and going into early next week, celebrating the 10-year anniversary of the Seattle WTO Ministerials.
Yeah, the first big day of demonstrations in 1999, the 10th anniversary of that is on Monday. So there are a lot of events, and we'll go through and talk about some of them at the end of the program that are happening this weekend and on into Monday and throughout the week. But we're also starting to get Seattle media coverage of the 10th anniversary of the WTO protests. And the media coverage and the commentary by local politicians and media leaders and whatnot is really, it's pretty infuriating. And the reason for that is that it is extremely myopic. Most of the, you know, official civic Seattle reaction to the WTO protests, or the anti-WTO protests, is basically along the line of, you know, our reputation as a world-class city, TM, has been besmirched. And the police were totally in line and trying to put down the rabble and keep the streets clean. And wasn't it a shame that those fine upstanding businesses downtown, all five of them or whatever it was, had their windows broken? And, you know, it's sort of like not being able to see the forest for a little bit of fungus on the stump of something that used to be a tree. It really misses the point.
Yeah, I actually think that the WTO protests proved that Seattle was a world-class city. I think one of the reasons why the WTO organizing committee wanted to locate it in Seattle was because there were massive protests against the earlier ministerials in Europe and elsewhere, and they decided, well, where can we put it in the United States, the center of capitalist neoliberal philosophy? Where can we locate the WTO meeting in the United States where we wouldn't expect protests, that would be fairly isolated, be hard for activists from Europe and elsewhere to get to? And so they chose a West Coast city that was far from New York and Washington, D.C., a city that was heavily dependent on trade, and that they figured, you know, people are going to be scratching their heads going, where the heck is Seattle?
And they were wrong.
Exactly.
but beyond that, you know, I don't think a lot of people here locally, certainly not among, you know, people like Jill Connolly at the PI, who wrote a ridiculous column on Wednesday, don't seem to understand that the protests here resonated around the world and have had a major impact on how trade policy and economic policy around the world has fallen out in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. Maria has made this point also that, you know, you probably would have seen the economic downturn of the last year and a half or so be much, much worse globally, especially in the global south, where you have many more desperately poor people that would have been literally endangered, in danger of their lives with a severe recession or depression. Those countries were not nearly as affected as the United States and Western Europe, specifically because the proposals that came into Seattle in 1999, which included radical deregulation of the financial markets, an instrument called the Multilateral Agreement on Investments, those things were expected to be rammed through in Seattle in 1999. They weren't, because African delegates and other third world delegates walked out of the proceedings, and they walked out in part based upon their inspiration from the people in the streets here. If that chain of events had not taken place, the depression worldwide would have been much, much more severe in the last year or so. You can draw a pretty straight line between the people in the streets in Seattle in 1999 and saving thousands, if not millions, of lives in the last year and a half. It really is not an exaggeration.
Yeah, and the fact that when the collapse came about a year and a half ago, when the financial economic collapse came, folks in D.C. and New York were scrambling really hard to isolate the panic in the financial system to the United States and to certain European governments like Iceland, for example. If Asian banks had been integrated into the deregulated financial system that we had in the U.S. and in Europe, then the economic downturn would have spread far beyond the U.S. government's capacity to control it.
Or any government's capacity.
Yeah, as it was, the U.S. government poured hundreds of billions of dollars into rescuing U.S. banks, rescuing the European financial system. This doesn't get a lot of coverage when you read about the economic downturn here and the bailouts that have occurred here in the U.S. There's not a lot of coverage of the amount of money that the U.S. has poured into the European system to rescue the European financial system as well. You know, European central banks borrowed a lot of money from the Federal Reserve.
And that was pretty early on. That was during the Bush administration.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was late 2008 in order to stabilize the system. If we had had to help finance the Asian banking system as well, then, you know, it's all bets are off as far as what would have survived and the amount of unrest that would have followed as well.
All right. Anything more on that, or
let's move along.
Okay,
we're short on time. Thank you.
Yeah. So it appears there was a decision this week that the wheels on the bus will continue to go round and round.
Oh yeah, this is after hearing dire predictions from the King County Council and from the interim King County executive Kurt Triplett that we were going to have to cut Metro bus service by 9% next year. Well, it turns out that the King County Council has found the extra money to plug the hole. A large part of that money came from the bus replacement fund, extra money that was in the bus replacement fund, so we won't be getting new buses anytime soon, but they're not going to cut bus service by 9%, thank God, because right now bus service is in higher demand than ever with the ridership increasing by record amounts last year and probably this year as well. But we're going to see an additional 25% fare increase in 2011 that comes on top of the fare increase we had this year and the 25-cent fare increase we're going to have in 2010. But it also assumes some iffy things like increasing advertising wraps on buses. I'm not so sure that's going to increase.
I don't hear the advertising industry is actually doing very well these days.
I don't hear that either. But it also assumes, too, that they're going to drop 43 positions in Metro, including park and ride maintenance workers, customer service workers, and some security jobs. So that's not good news. And it also means cutting the amount of layover time or break time in between routes for Metro personnel. So it may also cut into some of the on-time service that we're so used to here. We're used to Metro being on time at least during the weekdays. And on the weekends, Metro bus routes run on average about 5 to 10 minutes late, sometimes 15 minutes late. But usually they're pretty on time. And that on-time record may suffer because of the cuts in layover times.
All right. And then the state of Washington, things are not looking good for its health care.
Yeah, basic health care plan fell into the dubious position this year of having more people on the waiting list than are actually on the plan. Basic health covers folks who can't afford health insurance and who fall into the poverty category. There are currently 80,000 people on the waiting list. Those folks who are actually on the basic health care plan for the first time ever in the last couple of years, the last biannual budget, were forced to pay a portion of their premiums. Right now, they pay an average of about $34 per month. That's going to go up next year to $60 a month, and that's going to put a lot of stress on people who don't have that money and are probably going to fall off the plan simply because they can't afford even what the basic health plan covers.
All right.
Oh, and I also want to point out too that with a $2.6 billion shortfall in the state government's fund, that Democrats in Washington State are looking at cutting out the basic health plan altogether at a time when it's more necessary than it's ever been.
That's because we elect Democrats to, you know, look after the little people.
No, that's right. Because our Democrats don't look after the
little
people.
Moving on to national, a big speech coming up this next Tuesday.
Yeah, looks like President Obama is going to, a week before he receives the Nobel Peace Prize, go ahead and authorize a dramatic escalation in Afghanistan troop deployment. If you believe the New York Times anyway, 34,000 or so new troops in Afghanistan, and really a counterinsurgency strategy that continues to be extremely extremely heavy on military intervention at a time when civilian infrastructure and pumping up the civilian economy is taking a back seat. This in a failed narco state without really a legitimate central government where warlords and drug production basically rule the economy, and people are both fighting for the Taliban and working in the drug trade primarily because there's no other way to make a living. And I sat down and actually did the calculation on this. For the $1 million or so per soldier that it costs to deploy U.S. troops to Afghanistan, simply for the amount of additional troops that President Obama is putting into Afghanistan, you could actually put cash in the hands of every Afghan citizen that is equivalent to 120% of the per capita GDP of the country. It's a remarkable waste of money, not to mention being militarily ineffective, not to mention leading to the almost certain deaths of some U.S. service people and an untold number of Afghan civilians. It really is a disastrous decision, and one that should not come as any great surprise, Nobel Peace Prize notwithstanding. Even in 2008 as a candidate, Obama made very clear that this was the course of action that he supported. He's made some noises in recent months about reconsidering that, but in the end he's going forward with it. And, you know, welcome to our quagmire.
All right, and along those same lines, the Obama administration choosing not to go honor the landmine treaty?
That is correct. Obama saying in Colombia, I believe it was, he made the announcement that landmines were still essential to the national security of the United States, which, funny thing, they don't seem to be essential to the national security of any other civilized country in the world.
Yeah, aren't there 100-plus countries that have signed the landmine ban treaty?
Yeah, and many of the countries that have not signed it are countries whose governments received those weapons from the United States. So it really is a situation where if the United States had signed on to this treaty, it could have put an end to one of the most inhumane weapons and one of the cheapest and most easily produced weapons that's available anywhere in the world, one that disproportionately affects civilians, particularly children, and that they stay alive long after civilian, whatever conflict they were deployed in ends. So it really is an inexcusable decision on behalf of the Obama administration, and once again, very, very disappointing.
All right. Moving on to California.
Yeah, this week the California Air Resources Board released a draft rule setting up a cap and trade program, and very strong carbon emissions, well, stronger at least, than are being talked about by the U.S. government for the Copenhagen discussions in a couple of weeks. The California Air Resources Board said that they wanted to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the state of California to 1990 levels by the year 2020. That's a pretty ambitious goal, considering what's being proposed right now on the national level. They said that industrial and utility emissions would be regulated starting in 2012 and transportation emissions starting in 2015. And I just want to point out that California, by some measures, is considered the world's eighth largest economy. It also has some other economic issues that are impacted heavily by global warming, including water resource issues and drastic wildfire problem that we saw a lot of, particularly this year, that are going to get worse if global warming increases at the rate that it's being predicted to increase.
All right. And how about this week's economic news?
Yeah, the big news this week was that the FDIC, I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, the FDIC fund to bail out failing banks is in the red. The negative balance in the fund is about $8.2 billion. It already takes into account money that was set aside to bail out anticipated bank failures in the next year or so. But, that's if things go well. That's an optimistic view. Some folks think that many more banks will fail than the FDIC is anticipating, and that could be a problem. The number of problem banks on the FDIC's list increased from 416 banks in the second quarter to 552 banks in the third quarter. So even the FDIC's dire predictions earlier in the year of the number of banks that are expected to run into trouble is increasing. It's not decreasing as you would expect from all the sort of happy talk you hear in the mainstream press about the economy is recovering, etc. The FDIC says that they're expecting to collect about $45 billion from a prepayment of annual assessments that banks are going to be making to the FDIC fund. Every year banks make a payment, what's called an annual assessment, to the FDIC in order to fund their bailout fund for failing banks. The FDIC has ordered banks to prepay their annual assessments through 2012. That's supposed to bring in about $45 billion. However, if that will just barely cover the number of banks they expect to fail within the next 5 years. If that number keeps growing, as it appears to be growing, as the list of banks in trouble keeps growing, then that $45 billion is not going to be enough. And the FDIC is going to have to go to Congress, or it's going to have to go to the Treasury and start asking for more money. And as I've talked about in earlier programs, Sheila Bair, the head of the FDIC, doesn't get along with Timothy Geithner. They have a very different idea of how to rescue the financial system. So it could be very hard for the FDIC to get that money.
All right. And
then we had rumors of problems in Dubai. The Dubai government has asked banks on Thursday to suspend their debt repayments for the Dubai government's main investment company, Dubai World. That means that Dubai World, the company that manages all the investment activity for the Dubai government, has literally run out of cash to make their debt payment repayments. That sent the investment markets, particularly the credit markets and the bond markets, reeling on Thursday and Friday. So we saw European and Asian markets plunge pretty dramatically on Thursday. And then on Friday, when the U.S. markets were open for a short day, they dove as well. The real test is going to be what happens on Monday when Wall Street opens for a full day of business. We'll see what happens then. Dubai World, it turns out, is $59 billion in debt. Most of that was run up to fund an enormous surge in real estate investment. For folks who don't know, Dubai is one of the seven nations that make up the United Arab Emirates. It's considered the Las Vegas of the Middle East. It's basically a collection of islands that are shaped like a palm frond. And Dubai itself produces no oil, but it's a playground for the wealthy folks who have made their oil money. And it contains everything from extremely expensive condominiums to an indoor skiing facility in the Middle East. And it turns out that the property values in Dubai are plunging terribly. So that means that a lot of folks who have invested in Dubai are suffering. And also a lot of companies I've noticed who have major shareholders who have their money in the Middle East, those companies, their stock prices are suffering just because of this news. So yeah. That's so interesting.
So that would lead us to the conclusion of Dubai Cruel World.
Dubai Cruel World. Oh, Jeff.
All right.
New record for bad, I think, in terms of our.
Okay, moving on.
Jokes, I think.
Tasers.
Yeah. We've talked from time to time on this program about the abuse of police authority and police abuses, and certainly when it comes to tasers, which lead to a number of unnecessary deaths each year, there have been a number of horror stories out there. You read almost a new one every week, but this one is a new low. An Arkansas policeman was suspended this week after tasering a 10-year-old girl who repeatedly, quote, screamed, kicked, and resisted when her mother tried to get her to take a shower before bed. I'm just going to read this. Officer Dustin Bradshaw, called to a domestic disturbance in Ozark, Arkansas on November 11th, found the girl, this is according to his report, curled up on the floor screaming. He wrote that the girl was violently kicking and verbally combative. Yeah, you know, those 10-year-old girls, you have a really hard time controlling them when they're verbally combative.
You mean she was having a temper tantrum, right?
Exactly. And noted, quote, and this is the part that blows my mind, her mother told me to tase her if I needed to. Now, Now, which is worse here? Mom, who's watched too many episodes of Cops, or the officer who actually took her at her word? When Bradshaw attempted to arrest the child, a 10-year-old, for having a temper tantrum, she kicked him in the groin. So he gave her a, quote, very brief stun to the back of less than a second, as Police Chief Jim Noggle put it. Bradshaw was then able to handcuff the subdued suspect. I'll bet she was subdued, and she was taken into custody. Tasers are not a non-lethal weapon, and their use by police departments and their training for police officers has gotten entirely, entirely out of control. And, I mean, this is one anecdote, but it's one anecdote of thousands that are out there, and it's just, it's an abominable situation.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with the Philippines.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the Philippines election violence, an incredibly gruesome mass murder that was committed on the southern island of Mindanao, in which about 57 people, 57 bodies exhumed so far from a mass grave of people who were executed, members of the opposition party, who were trying to register, actually the wives and female relatives of some opposition party politicians who were trying to register to run in an upcoming election in the Maguindanao province on the southern island of Mindanao in the Philippines. About a dozen of those female relatives and wives of opposition politician leaders, plus about 30 journalists who were accompanying the women to the registration office because they thought that having journalists with them would mean that the ruling party would not commit any violence against the group, plus an additional number of people who were just innocent bystanders who happened to be at the roadblock when the whole group was picked up by a militia. Taken to a hilltop and slaughtered. And it turns out that the women in the group were separated from the rest of the group, were taken off, were sexually assaulted, and then they were killed and their bodies mutilated. The only reason that people have come forward and been arrested because of this is because some of the folks who participated, some of the men who participated in the assault, came forward and felt guilty about it because of the bystanders and the journalists who were killed, not because of the women who were sexually mutilated and murdered. This is just incredible. I haven't read anything like this for a long time. But what really struck me was that the militia was run by a large local family, the Impatuans, who are not just allies of Philippine President Gloria Arroyo, but they are her main allies in Mindanao. The militia itself almost certainly received money from the Arroyo government, and a lot of that money almost certainly came from the $1.6 billion per year in aid that the U.S. gives to the Philippine government, primarily to arm and train the Philippine military and these militias to fight terrorism, in the war on terrorism, to fight Islamic activists, and to put down communists and
particularly in Mindanao and other southern islands.
Activists, yeah. Particularly in what is considered the center of Islam, of the Islamic insurgency, which is Mindanao.
All right. And very briefly, the U.S. and China.
Yeah, the U.S. and China both announced emissions targets for the upcoming Copenhagen climate talks. The White House said that they want to reduce emissions, quote, in the range of 17% below 2005 levels by 2020, and then 83% below 2005 levels by 2050. We've talked about this before, how 2005 levels are record highs, and you compare that to the much lower 1990 levels, and this is not much of a target. Plus, China said this week that they wanted to cut their emissions growth, and they used a measure called carbon intensity, which is the amount of CO2 emitted per unit of economic output. Basically, that would just slow their growth of carbon emissions by about what they say is by up to 50% of their usual growth rate. That would be about a 13% decrease. That's also a very easy target, one that they can easily meet with their current activities.
And entirely inadequate to actually have an impact on global warming.
Yes.
All right. Let's go to events.
Yeah, a lot of things going on this week. And if you haven't gotten your tickets for Copenhagen, by the way, you really should. A lot of people from this area and veterans of 1999 who are going there, and this is really starting to look a lot like another very transformative moment in the struggle for global justice, largely because the United States, once again, isn't doing anything, and politicians aren't doing anything on an issue of critical importance. But a lot of things going on in the next few days in commemoration of 1999. Just to hit a couple of the high points, the Yes Men are, at least one of the Yes Men, Andy, is in town, and their premiere of their new film, The Yes Men Fix the World, is going to be showing at the Northwest Film Forum with Andy in attendance today and tomorrow. Also today and tomorrow at Seattle University, starting in about 2 minutes, is the People's Summit, and I'm not even going to try to list all of the really prominent and exciting national and local plenary speakers and workshop leaders and whatnot that are going to be happening at that. But
I think it's best to just go and show up and then see what you want to do.
just go and show up. There's over 30 workshops there. A lot of really good things happening. It's absolutely free.
Where's
Seattle,
it being held?
Seattle University, Campion Hall and Pigott Hall. I think it's been called, I don't know if it's Pigott or Peugeot, but
it's Pigott Hall.
That's what I thought. Anyway, that's today and tomorrow all day from 9 to 5 o'clock. Then there are plenaries both evenings. Tonight is at New Hope Baptist Church, dinner at 6 p.m. with locally grown produce, etc. And then a lot of entertainers and community leaders at 7:30. And then Sunday evening, a plenary at Town Hall featuring Leo Girard from the U.S. Steelworkers, Patty Goldman from Earth Justice, Eric Holt Jimenez from Food First, Theo Lee of the AFL-CIO, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Monday, the actual anniversary of N30, there will be a 4 p.m. Westlake rally for immigrant worker rights justice. And I also hear tell there's going to be a few direct actions on Monday, but I won't go into those details. And then there will also be a climate justice event Monday at 5 o'clock, both of those at Westlake Park, 4th and Pine.
I heard the Monday thing goes actually from noon. I mean, there's stuff happening noon to 6, basically.
So. Yes, that's very – if you just go to Westlake Park on Monday, you'll probably run into something.
Dress appropriately.
Exactly. Everybody's going there from Monday. And then Tuesday night, December 1st, there will be a WTO potluck and storytelling that will be at University Baptist Church, 47th and 12th Northeast. Again, food at 6 o'clock and then program, I believe, at 7. Also on Tuesday, December 1st, opposite Obama's speech on Afghanistan, people are trying to pull together a demonstration against escalation of the war in Afghanistan. So look for details on that as they come together. All of the events this weekend around the WTO are free, and information on all of them can be found at www.seattleplus10. That's spelled PLUS and then the number 10, SeattlePlus10.org.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found around town where you find free publications in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, restaurants, and bars. You can also find us in the King County Library System. And we are also on the web at www.eatthestate.org.
And the issue that's out this week, as of Thursday actually, came out on Thanksgiving, is has a lot of WTO material in it, both from 1999 and from where we are now and where we are going forward.
Some good articles on the impact of the protests in 1999.
So get it while it's hot.